the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
One of the big issues facing many retirees today is elder abuse. It comes in different forms. It could be physical, psychological, emotional, and financial, and sometimes neglect. Joining me on the program is Carolyn Rosenblatt from AgingParents.com. She's also the author of The Family Guide to Aging Parents. Carolyn, I want to talk about elder abuse. And one of the things that I have seen in my practice, and we've been in this business for almost four decades now, this was something I did not see until I would say probably the last 10, 15 years. Have you found that to be the case? And if so, what is behind this trend? Because it seems to be accelerating. We're finding more and more cases of it within our practice every year.
Well, let me give you my perspective as a nurse. And as an attorney, very interested in this subject because I think a lot can be done to prevent it. First of all, it's nothing new. This has been going on for centuries. We had laws on the books, old English law, that talked about taking advantage of other people. We have a problem with longevity in that it puts people more at risk. I think one of the reasons that you're seeing more of it is that there are 73 million baby boomers who are getting older, who are retirement age, who are accessing rather than putting into their nest eggs. And some of their relatives, caregivers, friends, or professionals in their lives see this as an opportunity to steal. And we have another difficulty here, which is that it's very easy to steal money from someone who knows you and trusts you. We call that undue influence in California, but it's really taking advantage of the relationship. And I think because people are older, a little more vulnerable, perhaps their decision-making capacity is not what it once was. Maybe they have beginnings of dementia. Opportunists in their lives take advantage of that, and that's why you're seeing it more. They're just more people at risk.
You know, one issue that we see sometimes, and you really have to be alert to it, and that is an aging parent who is declining in mental capacity, but who is still in charge of the finances and is making decisions that are really detrimental to their own financial health. And yet they may have a successor trustee, either a professional or in many cases, family members who have not yet stepped in. I'm dealing with a case right now where an individual actually used to be in our business, was very successful at it. And what he's doing now financially is just very detrimental to his health, where we had to basically step in and alert other family members that what this individual is doing was financially detrimental. What do you do in a case like that? In our case, we had to notify other family members, but what do you do when the adult is maybe failing in some certain ways from mental capacity, but is still in charge of making the major decisions?
There is plenty people can do about it, and I think there is a reason why people hesitate, family members hesitate. Let's take the typical scenario of a widow who is supposed to be managing her own finances. She's getting elderly and frail. Maybe she has some memory loss issues, signs of dementia. Maybe she's even been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease or other dementia. Her family members are in denial, Jim. They know there's a problem. They don't act, partly because they're not quite sure what to do, and that's where I spend a lot of time advising people directly, but also because they're afraid to confront the parent. It's this childlike role switching. They're uncomfortable parenting the parent. Now, I have several cases like that right now myself, and one of them involved a woman who was 92, living across the street from her bank. She had multi-millions of dollars, and she was lonely and became victimized by telephone predators who befriended her on the phone and persuaded her that she'd won this lottery, and she liked to play the lottery. So they were going to come and give her $1 million. All she had to pay was the transfer fee. They were going to come in person and walk her to the bank. Her son intervened. After I sat down with him, gave him some advice, I said, listen, your mother is incompetent. You're the successor trustee. you need to step up and take over your role. Let's look at the trust. So we look at the trust. It says exactly what's needed, which is that she had to be told or said that she was incapacitated by two doctors according to the terms of the trust. And he could get her to the two doctors, or he could ask her to resign, which was also part of the trust language. He asked her to resign. That was the simplest way. That is something that every trust has, if it was competently done, is a provision about what happens when the elder becomes incapacitated. So for your listeners, Jim, I think the most important takeaway is this. If you think your client is A, potentially being victimized by someone, or B, not necessarily being victimized right now, but they're showing signs of unraveling mentally, memory loss, confusion, can't keep track of the conversation, whatever it is, you have to look at the estate planning documents. And if you need to seek legal advice, do that. But find out exactly what the family trust says about the trustee, that's the dad or mom that's failing, resigning or being removed. That language directs what you have to do next.
All right. Let me bring up another issue that I have found in that when you do say cases of elder abuse, you brought up it's easy to steal money from someone who knows you. So a parent knows their children. In the cases that I have seen, Carolyn, the abuse has come from children or an in-law or a sibling who's named as successor trustee. How do you avoid that?
It depends on the circumstances and who's available to be an advocate for the elder. If there's more than one sibling in the family, the person who is committing abuse, and you got to have some evidence, you can't just think it's happening, you got to have some data, withdrawals, bank records, whatever it is, you can go to court with an attorney and petition the court to have that person removed as successor trustee based on the fact that they have breached what the law calls their fiduciary duty to the person who made the trust, the parent. That's not impossible to do, but the trick is you've got to have evidence to show that they are abusing their duty to the parent. And that takes some hard data, some numbers, because a lot of times the real dilemma we face, Jim, is that the parent loves the person who's stealing from them, and they don't want to get them in trouble. They become what I call the willing victim of abuse. They will allow it, they know it's wrong, but they are unwilling to step up and protect themselves, even if they are going to be financially decimated. And that is something we really can't change, because without their cooperation, unless they are completely incompetent to speak for themselves, we have a problem with enforcing the law.
We had a situation, and I'd like to get your opinion on this, where the husband who made the financial decisions had dementia, so his capacity to make decisions was failing. One of the children was named as successor trustee, but began to do things that were somewhat financially abusive, borrowing money, spending money, taking things. And what we were able to do, fortunately, was that we notified basically the wife, and she stepped in, and we named a co-trustee, a professional, to come in that put a stop to it. What about in cases where there is that potential of naming, let's say, a co-trustee, a family member, so the family feels like somebody has the family interest, but an outside independent trustee is co-trustee?
That can work. There is no guarantee that, let's say, a bank trustee is going to do the right thing. I've seen failures by bank trustees, and it's horrible because they have lots of money to fight against anybody questioning them. I don't think that's always the safest. I think there are professional licensed fiduciaries in California, particularly, who are going to be just fine. They need to be someone reputable who's not going to join in with the abuser and make things more difficult for the beneficiary of the trust. But I think the most important thing to understand is that even if a trust is written with a child who is not acting right, is doing things that are abusive, that doesn't have to be a permanent situation. The difficulty with putting a co-trustee on the trust with an abusive person is that they can cancel each other out. It does not necessarily solve the problem of who is going to make the final decision. And if you go to the bank with two trustees in dispute, they'll freeze the account and force people to try to work it out, which means they have to spend money getting lawyers. And they might both be removed so that someone neutral can be appointed. Sometimes it's better to just have a completely different person or persons serve in the capacity, typically a professional, because they are accountable and are going to show what's happening to every penny. That is their job. That is their legal requirement as fiduciaries, to be transparent and to do proper accounting. Have that person in charge and get the abusive person or potentially abusive person off that document.
Yeah, we have found, like you, Carolyn, that we use fiduciaries because we have found they are much more effective, more personal than large banking institutions, as you point out, who have lots of money that they can fight you on that. I want to talk about another issue, and that is the role of advisors, because a lot of times, in my opinion, the advisor is on the front line, either a financial planner or investment advisor, because you know your client. The client, let's say you've had a relationship with that client for a number of years, you know their spending patterns, you know their budget, and then all of a sudden you start to begin to see irregularities. What would you advise to advisors? You and I were talking just before we went on the air of an abusive case that you came across, and it was finally until $500,000 had gone from the account that the advisor acted. What is your advice to advisors? Because it seems like we, in many cases, are on the front lines of this.
Yes, Jim, you are on the front lines, and you have my deepest respect for the fact that you have intervened in all three of the matters that you told me about where you saw or suspected abuse. That's not what most advisors are doing. Most of them are sitting on their hands and making excuses. Oh, I can't contact the family because they're privacy issues. Oh, it's not my business. Oh, it's the family's problem. And until it gets to be extreme and maybe the money is gone or too much money is gone, the advisor is not motivated to act. So my word to advisors is this. On my other website, aginginvestor.com, there is a free downloadable checklist, the 7 warning signs of financial elder abuse. Get it. Look at it with your clients. If you see something going on, you are going to be mandated to do something about that according to your financial industry regulatory authority starting in 2018. So that means you're supposed to hold transactions for 25 business days. That isn't going to solve all the problems, but it will give you a chance to reconnoiter, to try to find out who is available to help you stop this problem. You took the lead, Jim, and did the smart, right thing, the ethical thing, which is to get the people involved who could put a stop to the abuse. We wish every advisor did that, but they're not. There's a lot of confusion. People are not clear about their role. You're right that advisors are very close to the client. You have an obligation, ethically and legally, to know your client. That means if they're taking out X number of dollars a month and suddenly that number goes up by a twofold or more, there's something wrong here. You need to call the client and find out, and don't be satisfied with vague excuses. They may be under pressure. They may be under undue influence. There could be a lot of reasons. But unless you have a legitimate explanation for why these strange withdrawals are happening, you had better suspect elder abuse and get moving so that you can stop it.
You know, some of the areas that you see in these abusive cases, maybe a parent doesn't want to name children because, let's say, the children have moved away from, let's say, mom's the survivor. She lives in California. The kids are on the East Coast or in the Midwest. And then they name sometimes dear friends who are as frail or the same age as they are. They don't realize that, you know, they're creating problems for themselves if they don't name backup. So let's talk about backup trustees, because one of the issues we've come across where I can think of a client who named a very dear close friend of hers who was just as old as she was. Unfortunately, she passed away. And so we had to come in once again and say, look, we need somebody. In this case, we did get a fiduciary because the kids weren't interested in doing it, but we needed somebody there when that time arrives. Let's talk about backup trustees and their importance.
Sure. And any competent estate planning attorney will build into the documents what happens if something amiss goes wrong with the successor trustee. Okay. Let's say the elder is no longer competent and the trustee has to be the one in charge. The trustee is a similar age to the original trustor. That's not a good idea. You know, the reason people name their children is because they suspect that their children are going to not only outlive them, but be able to take care of them when they get old. That's kind of our culture. And oftentimes that's true. But I think that it's very unwise for any lawyer to place the best friend just because the client wants that. It's the lawyer's job to tell the client that it's not a smart idea because they're going to get old too, and everyone's more at risk for safe decision-making about money as we age. That's just a fact of life. So it is time for everyone who has a client, or if you are the client, who has named a friend similar age as you on your trust document to take over when you can't do it anymore, that you need to update your estate documents by going back to the lawyer who drafted them or getting a new lawyer if that lawyer is no longer available and changing the successor trustee and naming someone else and a second someone else to take over. If that has to be a professional fiduciary, that's fine. You can also name a nonprofit organization, let's say Jewish Family Service Agency, Institute on Aging, something like that, where professional fiduciaries exist in a nonprofit organization dedicated to the service of elders. That solves the problem of the failing older friend or passing away person who can't do the job when the job is needed.
You know, let's talk about another area too, and sometimes this is where the financial advisor can come in, and you talked about your particular case where the woman liked to play the lottery and was almost taken advantage of on some of these scams, because this happens a lot to seniors. You know, they get calls on the phone, and especially sometimes when they're, I hate to say it, but there are people out there that read the papers for obituaries and they prey on the elderly. And sometimes an individual may do something, get scammed, or they're doing something and they're ashamed of it and they don't want to admit it. So they don't want to come to a loved one, one of their children, and say, hey, I've gotten scammed a couple times. What do you do in cases like that?
I think there are things that people can do that are protective of their aging parents. Let's assume that the people who are listening to us talking today, Jim, are people who actually care. They're not the thieves, all right? Now, I've got a 95-year-old mother-in-law. She's pretty sharp. She does okay, but she was recently victimized by a person posing on the telephone to be from Medicare. She had a Medicare dispute over a bill. It was like $1,500. But this person had probably gotten the names of people who have claims with Medicare from an inside source. The thieves are very clever. They buy names. They get names on the dark web. They have all kinds of ways of getting the names of seniors. And this person called her on the phone, said he was from Medicare, just wanted to verify her account, managed to get from her her full name, her mother's maiden name, her date of birth, her address, her social security number. We found out about this. She was embarrassed. She told my sister-in-law, and it just so happened we were in her location, which was, you know, in Southern California. We had jumped on a plane. We're going to be there anyway. It took us 4 days to get this cleaned up, going to banks, changing her account, da-da-da, all the different things you have to do when someone has potentially stolen your identity. So I think one of the primary things listeners need to know is that you can have online access to your parents' account as long as you have their permission. You need to watch all the time. You need to look at this daily or weekly or however often your aging loved one is interacting with other people on the telephone or the internet. You can see if something is amiss. You also need to engage them in conversation and remind them over and over, never give out personal information on the telephone to anyone who calls you.
You know, this is something, unfortunately, that we're seeing a lot of Medicare scams or, for example, seminars where supposedly you can protect all your assets from Medicare if you go into a long-term care facility. We recently discovered a fraud there. So, Carolyn, if you were to boil this down to some really proper planning steps to make sure that this abusive issue does not come up financially. And of course, we're not dealing here with some of the other issues that are prominent that sometimes can happen, psychological and emotional abuse. We had a case where basically one of the siblings was emotionally abusing his mother. And it was basically emotional abuse with the intent to get money from mom. So if you were to boil this down to some easy steps or some rules that you have found to be very effective in avoiding this, what would they be?
Let me use the example of what we're doing with my 95-year-old mother-in-law, okay? Because my husband, Dr. Nicole Davis, is a geriatric psychologist. I'm a nurse and an attorney. we're supposed to be experts in this field, right? I write books, I blog, I have all kinds of things going on to try to educate the public. If I'm not practicing what I preach, then I'm not effective. Here's what we do. Number one, stay in frequent contact with your loved one. If you have a sibling or somebody who's supposed to be doing the caretaking or the watching, don't completely trust that that's going to be the case. Nobody's perfect, all right? My mother-in-law is agreed to call her son every morning at 10 o'clock, okay? And she's pretty good about it. If she doesn't call, he calls her. That's a good way to see what's happening. Number two, be sure that you are aware of what the estate documents say and that they are updated. Because if your brother, who was supposed to be in charge after mom's no longer capable, is now a drug addict, you got to change the documents while your parent can still do that, herself or himself. Things change. Some of these documents don't get updated for 20 or 30 years. The lawyer dies. The person moves. You have to think about doing that right now, even though your parent doesn't want to, even though it may be unpleasant. Number three, remember that every single person who is aging is at risk for losing their decision-making capacity. This applies to advisors, Jim, and it applies to everybody else in families. Just because mom or dad went to Stanford or has a doctorate in economics or used to be a CPA or a bank president does not mean that that person is immune from losing their capacity for safe decision-making about money, and we all need to safeguard the people we love. The next thing to remember, Jim, is that the most common predators out there in the world are family members. They steal the most often for the reasons we've been discussing. They can get away with it. The parent trusts them. They have easy access. Everybody else who's not on the document, not in charge, needs to be paying attention and know that the law is there to help you if that person who is supposed to be in charge is doing something wrong. You have a voice. You can get legal advice. Changes can be made. You have to have evidence to accomplish that. And the fourth thing is to think about ourselves, your listeners, our own family members. Some of us are senior citizens. We need to be incorporating these things into our own lives so that we will be safe. All the things that apply to our parents apply to us, too.
You know, one thing that we've started to do, and I've got this from reading some of the things on your own website, is when we get involved in an estate plan where the client allows us to work with their attorney, we also ask the client and the attorney, should we detect something, who would you want contacted? Who would you want notified? So the client knows if we suspect something, and this is something that we used, Carolyn, with this retired investment advisor who were managing his estate, working with him. He still makes some of the decisions, but we noticed the quality and deterioration. In other words, he was doing things that just didn't economically sound logical. And we basically had the permission in the estate plan to contact a daughter who was an accountant, so at least she would understand. And that's exactly what we did. And now she's moving into the role of trusteeship. But what about the advisor part of it?
We have a whole do-it-yourself, you know, package for advisors. It's basically done for advisors who want to have a policy that anticipates every one of these things we've talked about with a built-in, I think pretty bulletproof, privacy waiver document. You do have a dilemma in contacting third parties about your client's confidential information, just as lawyers do, as doctors do. You can't just call anybody because you feel like it or you're worried. You have to have permission, and getting permission has to be done way ahead of time when the client is still competent. So you need a privacy document that is legally sufficient in the file. In that document, the client is allowed to name who they want you to contact, and you need several people because, as we've talked about, you know, the person that they think is trustworthy might be the abuser. So you got to have other people that you also have permission to contact. I encourage putting these kinds of things into the estate planning documents, and I very much encourage getting permission from the client to have communication with the estate planning attorney because they have a role, but the role ends at a certain point. And that is, they've done the estate planning documents for the client. They have a duty of loyalty to the client. They have confidentiality. But when something goes wrong, the client is not going to call them. It's up to the family, and the family members are not their client. So that's where the advisor comes in. You are close to the person. You know your client. You see something amiss. You then have permission from your client to contact the attorney and say, okay, the family needs education about who's the successor trustee or whatever the issue may be. And you then have coordination of effort among professionals, which is one of the very best ways that we can keep our older folks safe.
You know, that is great advice, because I think in some cases, because I know fellow advisors in the field, they're reluctant to do something because, you know, you do have the privacy issue to deal with. And so they're somewhat reluctant until, you know, in the case that you talked about, where $500,000 it was gone, it finally became obvious, hey, something needs to be done here.
It was ridiculous to wait that long. And, you know, Investment News did a study about why advisors don't report financial abuse. Do you know one of the reasons they gave, and it was a significant percentage, they didn't know how to report it. It's a form. You call Adult Protective Services. You name the abuser. You name the date that the withdrawal of $50,000 for no apparent reason came out of the account. You know, you talk about the date and time. You put your name down, or you can do it anonymously, and you give them the form. That gets started with the criminal investigation. If it's not a criminal case, Jim, or there isn't enough data to prove something beyond a reasonable doubt, we have civil remedies. In our state of California, we have excellent laws about defining undue influence, defining elder abuse as a civil wrong as well as a criminal wrong. There are civil attorneys who take on these cases, and as long as there's something to get, they can help make a case. It's worth a phone call to one of these folks, very strong advocates for people, to see if the abuse can be stopped by other means.
Carolyn, as we close, if, let's say, we have advisors listening to this program, I want you to give out your website and the forms that they can look at to educate themselves and take proper action with their clients, but also your book for, let's say, children of aging parents, so they can find out how to deal with the issues we've been discussing in this interview.
Sure. Well, for the public, for people who have aging parents, The Family Guide to Aging Parents, which is available at agingparents.com, is a pretty comprehensive look at the legal, health care, and financial issues in families, how to talk to your older loved one about money. There's a chapter on elder abuse and prevention that could be useful. And for advisors, Jim, we have another website and a lot of tools for advisors, because I think, as you say, you're close to the client, you're on the front line. Sometimes you take the place of family. They tell you more than they tell their own children. And for that reason, we've developed some good tools for advisors, anybody in financial service. Those are at aginginvestor.com. That's aginginvestor.com. We have two books, Succeed with Senior Clients, is a best practices guide for all of you with a lot of data in it about diminished capacity. We have a brand new book called Hidden Truths About Retirement and Long-Term Care, which addresses some of the costs that you may not be aware of to help educate your clients. And we have a program initiator, which is a 10-step policy development kit available at aginginvestor.com. And that has in it all the forms that you need to create your privacy waiver document and all of the things that you need to have a solid, proactive policy in place to prevent these kinds of things from happening in the first place, the abuse, but to keep your client financially safer for life. There are also free downloadable checklists on both websites, which have the 10 warning signs of diminished capacity and the 10 red flags of financial elder abuse.
And once again, those websites are called agingparents.com and the other one, aginginvestor.com. Carolyn, I want to thank you for joining us on this program, because I think this is really an important subject that we just see more and more of it today. And the tragedy is a lot of this could be prevented up front with some proper planning.
You're welcome, Jim. And I want to thank you in particular for the work that you're doing to bring this to the attention of more people, for the efforts that you personally are making to thwart this scourge, the crime of the century of elder abuse, and to bring the attention that you're bringing to people about what they personally can do to change things. Hats off to you, and thank you so much for having me on your program.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Carolyn.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
You know, once again, if you're an advisor, I strongly recommend you go to Carolyn's website, aginginvestor.com. There's a number of things that you can adopt there that you can put in place in your practice to protect your clients, because, you know, we adopted a lot of those, and I have a lot of friends who are in the same business. And one of the things that they have told me many times is, gosh, I'm afraid to, you know, because of the privacy issues of, you know, contacting people when you see this firsthand going. And this is, by the way, an area that FINRA, in the SEC is also moving towards. So aginginvestor.com is a great place to go. And if you are in a situation where you are seeing your parents' age, you're noticing diminished capacity in financial decision making, or maybe even you suspect abuse or other areas, as Carolyn mentioned about the woman that was susceptible to lottery winnings, go to agingparents.com. There's so much information out there. With proper planning, all of this can be avoided. I'm Jim Poplava. Thanks for listening.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.